This morning, I am not going to try to talk about all the different subjects that you face as a Stephen minister, but I'd like to talk about one of the great pivotal experiences of life, which is the experience of loss. And I've called this talk Growing Through Grief. I know at first that may sound paradoxical, because any time you lose a person or an object or anything that is of value to you, following that experience of loss is going to be the process of grieving. A grief is much bigger than bereavement. Anytime a loss is experienced, what you're going to have afterwards is grief. And though at first it seems like you have been drained and robbed, I have found in my own experience that there are ways that the grief experience can actually lead to growth. It can lead one to a more profound appreciation of the mystery of life, and oftentimes can draw a person closer to other suffering people. I do not claim to be an authority on grief. I don't think such a thing exists. But I have in my own life experienced a series of losses, and it's going to be out of that that I would like to speak to you this morning. Back on July the 1st, 1968, I sat in the office of the chief hematologist at Children's Hospital in Louisville, Kentucky, and heard him say something that I could hardly comprehend when he first spoke it, which was that my 8.5-year-old daughter was suffering from acute lymphatic leukemia. She had not been well for some weeks, but we had no inkling that the issue was as serious as it turned out to be. And I was so shocked at first I couldn't even speak. And when I finally got back my voice, I did what I suppose you would have done. I asked the doctor, what are our prospects? Because at that time I knew nothing about leukemia. And being a good scientist, he said, well, of course, nobody can speak dogmatically, but I will tell you that the national average from diagnosis to death, this type of leukemia in this age child, is 18 months. Well, that afternoon turned my world upside down. We, from the moment we heard of this diagnosis, began to do everything that we could possibly think of to try to hold off this terrible disease and save the life of this precious little girl. We prayed for God to heal, as I do believe often happens. The one who made us can also mend us. We sought out the best medical resources that were available at that time, and I have nothing but gratitude for all the doctors, the nurses that helped us. But exactly 10 days beyond the 18 months projected period, on January the 10th of 1970, I stood by her bed on a snowy Saturday afternoon and watched with absolute awe. I watched her set out on a journey on which I could not accompany her. I had carried her little body back and forth to the bathroom, to the hospital so many times, and to see her leave and not be able to go with her was without a doubt one of the great, great sadnesses of my life. We called the undertaker and he came to get her body, and it was evening by that time, and I can still remember following her body down the steps. Her bedroom was upstairs. She happened to be at home when she died. And I can still remember the sight of those taillights of the hearse driving off in the snow, and I was standing out in the front yard feeling as empty and as devastated as I've ever felt in my life. It was the beginning of an enormous period of grief. Let me tell you out of that experience some of the things that did not help me, other people did, and then some of the things that did help me, because you as a Stephen minister are going to be called to be alongside people in this terrible, terrible time of losing. And this is not the last word on anything. It's hopefully the first word of a conversation. But let me reflect on some of the things that were done in those days after her death that did not help. And then I'd like to identify four things that did help, and then I'd love to entertain questions from you. The first thing that didn't help people's attempt to explain to me why Laura Lou had died. Now, I know we humans have minds, and it's certainly appropriate for us to try as best we can to analyze and understand events. But the truth is, when a mystery such as I was going through takes place, any effort to try to give it a reason is going to fall short, because there is a deep mystery that attends our finitude. And I know people meant well. I know they were trying to help me find some way, some reason to go on, but it was just incredible, some of the inane things that were said to me, like God must have needed her for his angel choir, or somebody else said, well, you're young, you can have some more children, as if they were interchangeable parts. And to be honest with you, any attempt to explain a profound tragedy, I think, is always going to come up short. That there is simply a mystery to life that cannot be fathomed. I've been greatly helped myself by something Frederick Buechner wrote in a little book he did about Bible characters. And in his section on the book of Job, he says that if you read that book, Old Testament book, carefully, you'll notice that God never does explain to Job why those terrible things had happened to him. And Buechner says he thinks there are two reasons for that. First of all, God could not, because God is the creator and therefore exists at a level that we finite creatures cannot even fathom. There would be no way to take someone who did not create this world, us, we the finite people like we are, there'd be no way that the infinite God, from God's perspective, could ever make clear to us all the different ways that mysterious forces at work. He said trying to explain those tragedies to Job would have been like trying to explain Newtonian physics to a small-necked crab. In other words, the capacity of the one is incommensurate with the immensity of the other. So he said God could not, because God exists on the uncreated level, all of us exist on the created level. We receive our lives from God. God is the only one who gives life. So he says, first of all, it was God couldn't, because Job was not the kind of creature that could have ever fully fathomed it. But he said the second thing, and I think this is more important, is that understanding and explanations are not what grieving people most need. He said if God could have made a chart on the wall and answered every question that Job could have raised, if the whole thing had become rationally clear, he said, even in the presence of that kind of absolute explanation, Job would have still had to find the courage to deal with the empty chairs at the breakfast room table. In other words, we don't get through tragedy by explaining it to each other. What we most need in the depths of our experiences of loss is not some rational framework, but some kind of courage that enables us to believe that there is still a future in spite of the painful present and the painful past. And so the first thing that didn't help were those people who tried to give it some kind of explanation. And I always found what they suggested to be inadequate. And my heart was broken, because something that had been so wonderful had come to an end. All grief, someone has said, comes back to this one thing. We run out of time. Something ends before we want it to. And there is an enormous, enormous pain to that premature closure on what has been a meaningful relationship. And I think it's safe to say that tragedy and grief are events to be lived through courageously. They're not intellectual playthings and puzzles to try to simply deal with in terms of mind games. So the first thing that didn't help were the people that attempted to explain it to me. The other thing that didn't help were the people who tried to rush me through my grief and get me back to normal as quickly as possible. I think all of us need to realize that when terrible things happen in our lives, it sends shockwaves of fear through everybody. When my little girl got sick and died, every parent that I knew was bound to have said, what would I do if this happened to my child? In other words, the vulnerability that we have to tragedy is made dramatic in people who are going through tremendous losses. And therefore, society has a vested interest in getting you back to looking normal as quickly as possible so you don't continually remind them of what any of us might have to experience, because none of us are completely exempt from dark and difficult things. And so I found that the people that 30 days after Larlu died wanted me never to mention her name again, wanted me to look like I had gotten back to normal. I found those people not to be helpful at all, because the truth is, it takes much longer than 30 days, much longer than 30 days to begin to try to find your way back to some kind of meaningful life in light of a loss. And one of the ways I think Stephen Minister can be so helpful is if you will be that patient person who doesn't try to rush, doesn't try to explain, but is simply with and for the grieving person. Because as I want to move on to the things that did help, the first thing I would have to say is that the people that were most helpful to me were those who came and obviously had let my sorrow penetrate their hearts, the people who came with tears in their eyes, and all they could say was, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry that this has happened. What happens to you makes a difference to me, and your pain has caused me pain. The people that were simply willing to be with and for me and patient enough to let me unpack my heart and not shame me for feeling this or thinking that, but simply companion me, those were the people that were of the greatest help. There's a wonderful old story about a man way back at the turn of the century when folks' transportation was horse and buggy. He was on his way to town one afternoon. He was a farmer, and his wagon got off in the ditch, and he couldn't get back up by himself. And a neighbor came by and saw his plight and stopped and unhitched his horse and hitched it to the wagon that was in the ditch, got down in the mud himself with the man, and together they were able to get the man's cart, the wagon, back up on the road. Well, the man who'd been helped was so grateful. And so he said to his Good Samaritan friend when they got it back up on the road, I deeply appreciate what you've done. You're stopping and willing to help me. And he said, I want to make you two promises. If I'm ever on my way to town and I find you with your wagon in the ditch, I promise I'll do for you what you've done for me. I'll do everything I can to help you get your wagon back up on the road. And if I can't do that, I'll tell you something else. I'll climb up and sit beside you until help does come. Now, sometimes all we can do for grieving people is simply be with and for them, to simply share in the sorrow that is theirs. Tears have a tremendous healing when you sense that you're not alone, that's what's happening to you makes a difference to other people. And so the people who didn't try to rush me, but the people who were willing to be patient, were very helpful. And that's why I think Stephen Minister, which doesn't attempt to be therapy, that doesn't attempt to be fixers, but is essentially a companioning kind of ministry, that is enormously potent, because sometimes just to know you're not alone is the loveliest thing that you can possibly experience. Another thing that was helpful to me were the folk who very quietly began to do practical things to help. I know the people that came after Larlu died to the house and answered the phone. The people who helped us put stamps on the envelopes when we tried to respond to all the affection that had been shown us. The people who brought food. It's an old country custom, whenever a death occurs, to come and bring a dish. And what it means is that somebody is saying, I know you've lost terribly, but here is a bit of food to help you make the next stage of the journey. the practical things, one of the worst things about a grief is that there's so much that needs to be done at the very time you don't feel like doing anything. I can remember that having to handle Larlou's death certificates was so painful to me, to see her name on a death certificate. I know that all grief is bad, and I'm not one to rank them, because anytime you lose, it hurts. But there is something unnatural about the death of a child. We don't go around talking about it, but we expect our children to bury us. We don't expect to bury them. There's something very out of sync with having to see your own flesh and blood go before you into the grave. And so the practical things of helping with the food, helping with answering all the condolences that have been given, that just the things that you don't have any energy for. I found right after Lalu died that it seemed like I had died, or at least a part of me had died. I can remember waking up in the morning and not being able to think of anything that was worth getting up for, because the emotional impact of grief is to feel like that there is no future, that which has given meaning to life is gone. And so I also found in my grief that I had trouble sleeping, and I was tired all the time, because grief is very fatiguing. But ironically, I couldn't sleep. And the people that therefore filled in for me and helped do the practical things were people that I look back on today with great gratitude. Perhaps the most helpful thing that occurred to me in the valley of the shadow of grief, and this is not an explanation, this is simply an image and an insight. Perhaps the most helpful thing that happened that helped me get on my way was something that occurred about 6 weeks after she died. I shared this here at Trinity one Sunday. It was one of those nights that I couldn't go back to sleep. Woke up about 2 a.m. And so finally, rather than just thrash around the rest of the night, I got up. I was a minister in Louisville, Kentucky when she died. I went down in my study and I pulled from my shelf a commentary on the book of Genesis by a German named Gerhard von Rod. And I went over to my desk and turned on the light. And I opened it up to the 22nd chapter of Genesis. If you know the Bible well, you may remember that's that chapter where you have that awesome story of Abraham being asked to offer his son Isaac as a burnt offering. I had always been puzzled by that passage. I'd never attempted to preach on it. And the only sense I'd ever been able to make of it was that this was the last gasp of paganism in the psyche of old Abraham. Before he encountered Yahweh, the God whose nature it is to bless, he'd grown up in a culture that said the gods are indifferent and hostile, and therefore they have to be appeased, they have to be bribed. And so the strategy in paganism was whatever opens the womb, be it an animal or person, is offered back as a burnt offering. Hopingly, the sweet-smelling savors will soften the hearts of the gods, and they'll be prompted to give more. And that was the background out of which Abraham had come when he was met by this God who said, it's my nature to bless. And you know as well as I do that old ideas die slowly. And even though little Isaac was now 12, he had opened the womb. He was the firstborn of dear Sarah. And so that old idea that whatever opens the womb has to be offered back as a burnt offering was still plaguing the consciousness of old Abraham. And so, according to this interpretation, it wasn't the voice of God that said, go to Mount Moriah and sacrifice your son. It was the echo of paganism. And if you remember, it was God who stopped that process. And so, that was the only sense I could ever make of that old passage. But that night, as I opened this commentary by this German, he gave an entirely different frame of understanding. Von Rod said that he thought in this awesome episode, God was trying to find out, did Abraham remember where Isaac had come from? Did he remember that life is gift? birth is windfall, that everything that we are and have comes out of the generosity of another? Or had Abraham become possessive? Had he put his hand around little Isaac as if Isaac was his by entitlement, as if somehow his life was something for which he had deserved and earned? Did he see Isaac as a gift, or did he see him as a possession? Well, by Abraham's willingness, awesomely, to relinquish this beloved child, it was clear that he did remember that life is gift, that everything comes to us by grace. And so, as you know the story, the bloody process was stopped, a ram was substituted for the lad, and lucky old Abraham got to go down the mountain in the company of his child. But as I sat there in the middle of the night reading this commentary, it all of a sudden came to me in ways I had never, frankly, realized it before, that Laura Lou was a gift, that I had ever had her for a single day was incredible good fortune, that I had been able to get my life tuned to her life for those 10 years was a consummate, consummate gift. And as I saw her for the first time, perhaps, as the gift that she really was and not a possession, it was almost as if two roads opened up in front of me visually. And I realized as I sat there that I had a choice that night. I could take the road of resentment and spend the rest of my life with my fist in the face of God, screaming, it's not fair, it's not right, it's not just. I could spend the rest of my life resenting that she had lived for so short a time, or I could spend the rest of my life being grateful that she'd ever been given it all. I don't think I've ever had a more profound sense of freedom than I had in that moment. Those two paths were there. They were very different, and I realized I was going to have to decide whether I'd take the path of resentment or the path of gratitude and the path of wonder. And as I pondered the alternatives that were facing me, something else happened that I look back and think was a fulfillment of a promise that Jesus made right before he ascended. He said to the disciples, it's better for you that I go in this bodily form. I've done the work that I was supposed to do as the incarnate one. And I'm going to send the Holy Spirit. I'm going to come back in a form that I can be everywhere at work for good. And as the Holy Spirit, I'm going to bring back to your remembrance whatever it is you need to know as you need to know it. I'm going to give you the gift of wisdom and help you to recall the parts of the past that can help you with the present. And the reason I say that is that sitting there pondering that awesome choice, a memory came back to my mind that I promise you I'd completely forgotten. It had gone somewhere deep in my unconscious. But all of a sudden, it came bubbling back to the surface, and it was incredibly, incredibly relevant to the issue that I was facing that night. What I recalled, what was brought back to my memory, was something that happened in 1942. I was born in 1930, grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. We had this wonderful African-American lady who lived in our home all through my growing up years. Her name was Gladys Meggs. You could warm your hands by it. One of the most loving people I have ever known. Had very little education, but a wonderfully big heart. Well, she had cooked our meals, washed our clothes, cleaned our house. She was an integral part of my family as long as I could remember. But when the war came along, they opened up a big defense factory in Nashville, and she was offered a much better paying job than what my family could afford. Though she was very sad about it, Gladys decided to take this job. And so with great pain, we watched her leave. And believe me, as was the case in that southern way of life, her leaving just opened up huge vacuums in our practical life. She had done so much for us that we didn't fully realize till she was gone. And one of the things that she had done was to wash our clothes, and by that time gas was rationed and we didn't have a washing machine. And so the whole issue of how we're going to eat, how we're going to keep ourselves clean, was suddenly made very real. And about that time, one of my father's younger business associates was drafted, and his wife wanted to go with him. And so my father offered to let them use our basement to put their furniture in while they went to war. Well, as they were moving their stuff in, it turned out they had an old green Bendix washing machine. Now, you say that to young people today and they look at you blank. They don't know what you're talking about, but some of you here will remember the old uprights. It was green, it was about this tall, it had a big plunger in the middle. You'd put the water in, then you'd put the clothes and you'd put the soap, and it would jostle the clothes around and get them clean. It had a hand wringer also with rubber rolls that you, when the cycle of washing was over, you'd wring out the clothes and then take them out to dry. Well, my father must have asked, because I went in on this, could we use your washing machine in lieu of you using our storage space? And that was the agreement. And so I remember very vividly the night that my father told us that now we had a washing machine and how good that was. And then came the question, who's going to be the wash person in our family? Well, my mother played the piano for the opening Sunday school in the Baptist church that I grew up in. And when the issue of who's going to be the wash person was raised, I remember she said, everybody knows it's not good for a musician to put her hands in water. That's just not one of the things that I can afford to do. And my sister, who's 2 years older than I and much quicker witted, said, well, I'm taking piano. If it's not good for you, it would not be good for me. And I grew up in that kind of genteel poverty that I think of the Depression, where there wasn't enough money for everybody to take piano lessons. And I was the boy, and I wasn't taking piano lessons. And so in that strange mystery of how families assign roles, I, at the ripe old age of 12, got assigned the role of being the family wash person. And so for the whole time we were fighting in Europe and in the Pacific, every Tuesday and every Friday, I'd come home from school, I'd gather up the clothes, go down in the basement, fill the old Bendix with water, and put the clothes in, and watch as all kinds of wonderful configuration of suds would be caused. I can remember playing with that wringer. I would put my hand in just as far as I possibly could, see how far I could go without cutting off the circulation. The point is, I became affectionately bonded to that old machine in the 5 years that the war was going on. Well, it was over finally. Mr. Coates came back, and one day while I was at school, a truck came to our basement and out went everything that was there, including the washing machine. And nobody had told me this was going to happen. So it was a wash day. I gathered up the clothes, I went down, and I can still remember the incredible shock of seeing that empty place where the washing machine had been. And I put down the clothes and stormed back upstairs and said for everybody to hear, we have been robbed. Somebody has stolen our washing machine. And my dear mother, I'll never forget, said, John, you have obviously forgotten how that ever got to be in our basement in the first place. It never did belong to us. That we ever got to use it was incredible good fortune. And then she said, when something is a possession and it's taken away, you have a right to be resentful and angry. But when something is a gift from the beginning and it's taken away, you use that moment to be grateful that it was ever given at all. I promise you, I had completely forgotten that experience. But there in the middle of the night, with that commentary open on my lap and that sense that there were two roads out of the valley of the shadow of grief opening up in front of me, as I sat there, the words my mother had said 20 years before from some deep and sacred place came back to my mind. And I remembered her saying, if it's a possession and it's taken, you have a right to be angry. But if it was a gift from the beginning, you use the occasion of it being taken to give thanks that it was ever given at all. And that memory helped me make what I think is one of the wisest practical decisions I've ever made in my life. which was to take the road of gratitude rather than the road of resentment out of the valley of the shadow of loss. And let me be perfectly honest, it did not diminish the sadness one iota. Let's face it, if we have been engaged lovingly with somebody that really matters, and suddenly that person is taken away from us in that form, then there is no way not to feel overwhelming sadness. We will grieve to the proportion and depth that we have loved. If you've loved in a superficial way, then loss will not be all that difficult to negotiate. But if you have profoundly given your heart and affection to another, and then realize that the way it is far, far different from the way it was. And that awesome change that comes when a person is taken from us as we've known them, there's no way to sidestep the sadness that accompanies that kind of trauma. And therefore, my realizing that Laura Lou is a gift, and my deciding that I would choose to spend the rest of my life being grateful that she'd ever been born, rather than being resentful that she had died so prematurely. Even that decision, which I think is so basic, did not in any way lessen my sadness. But what it did do was to keep me from spending the rest of my life in bitterness, in rage, in anger against God. I think we need to realize that grief is a very perilous spiritual experience, because we don't get our way. Every grief is like a Gethsemane. You go in begging God for one thing, as Jesus did that night, and you come out with the opposite. And if your relationship to God is premised on the fact that he must give you your way or else, then I've known many people to lose all affectionate relationship to God in the experience of grief. But if you will step back from the death and loss of a loved one and ask, how did that person ever come to be in my life in the first place? If it ever dawns on you that everything is gift, everything, your life, what did you do to deserve being born? Your life, the life of those you love, everything comes to us from a gracious, generous mystery beyond our deserving. It doesn't keep us from being sad when we have experienced loss, but it does keep us from wasting the rest of our lives in a kind of anger and a kind of rage, which does not bring back the lost person. It does not in any way change the situation that is so painful. It simply takes more energy out of us than even the experience of loss itself. Therefore, I guess I would say to you that the single most helpful thing that came to me in this arduous journey through the valley of shadow of loss was being reminded that life is gift and that Laura Lou was gift. And I would to God that she was still alive. She's been dead now three times as long as she lived. It was 1970 she died. Here's 32 years later. I would to God she was still alive, and I still have moments of just overwhelming sadness that something ended before I wanted to. At St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Birmingham, we happened to have a center aisle, had lots of weddings, as you can imagine. And one of the most poignant things that used to happen to me was that in our church, the bridal party would come down, and then they would close the doors in the back, and the organist would modulate into a different level of music, and then usually would play the bridal chorus. And then the doors in the back would open. I'd be standing up front, and there would be a father getting ready to bring his daughter down the aisle. And every time I saw that, it flashed through my mind, I'll never get to do that. And that is a genuine sadness. So I'm certainly not telling you that there's a way for us not to suffer, because if you love and you lose, it's going to be painful. But it's been so helpful to me not to regard my little girl's death as some kind of theft, as some kind of intrusion into my life of powers that had no right to be there. Because I never deserved her for a single day that I ever got to have the grandeur, 10 years of affection. It's a gift beyond reckoning and in any way managing. And so I guess the most helpful thing, and you don't inject this into people like penicillin, but whatever you who work with grieving people can do, when it's appropriate, try to help them see the grace that is involved in everything, even in the experience of loss. And one of the ways we can grow through grace, grief, it seems to me, is that it deepens the mystery. It deepens the mystery of how any of us ever came to be, of why anything is what it is. And it seems to me that my life, which up to that time had not been scarred by much tragedy, I'm not proud of this, but I pretty much took life for granted. Before Lalu got sick, I had not been crossed significantly in my up to 40 years at that time. And once this happened to me, I took on a renewed appreciation for getting to be it all and getting to have related to this little one. So if you can somehow gently share with people that life is gift, birth is windfall, it doesn't lessen the sadness. It does keep you from a life of bitterness. Another thing that was helpful to me, and this happened about 6 weeks further into the journey after what I've just related to you, I had one other child who was 2 years older than his sister. And as life began to get back into more regular patterns, the three of us that were left of our family went to a little fish restaurant in Louisville where the four of us had gone many times when Lalu was well. And when we sat down at the table that night, the empty chair that made up our threesome, the empty chair that was there, suddenly brought home to me what we'd lost. It was like a stake going through my heart. I just felt this overwhelming pain, this irrevocable loss that we had all experienced. There was a musical playing on Broadway at that time called Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. That's exactly what I felt in that moment. I remember thinking, I just can't stand the pain of this. I just want to get away from it as far as I can. And with those emotions swirling in my saddened heart, I looked over at my 12-year-old son, and he looked so sad and so lonely. And, you know, there's just so much energy that any of us have. And let's face it, in a good family, the last are always first. That is, those that are having the greatest problems get the most attention. And though we had tried our best to do what we could for him, in those 18 months, he'd had to do lots of things on his own. We'd not been able to spend as much time with him. He looked so sad. He looked so vulnerable. He looked so lonely. And as I looked at him, all of a sudden it dawned on me, if you should act on what you're feeling, stop the world, I want to get off, he will conclude that Lalu was the only thing that mattered, that he doesn't have value. And it dawned on me that for all that I had lost, there was a lot of world left. There were people to love. There was still truth to learn, beauty to see. There was work to accomplish. All of a sudden, I began to sense that in the face of this enormous loss, there was still lots of meaningful possibility left. And looking back, I think that was the night I decided to live again. I think every grieving person comes to a crossroads where either you decide to stoop over and pick up the pieces and begin to try to make another kind of life for yourself, or you just give up altogether and allow the experience of loss to lead you not to have any meaning left in your life. And the truth is that profound grief causes great pain, but there is also a larger world. And as I gradually began to sense that I had a son that very much needed my affection, then a reason for living began slowly to come alive within me. And again, you don't rush people into this. You don't say this the day after a funeral. But the truth is, if you can begin to help people sense that for all they've lost, there is still the possibility of meaning, because the thing that draws us into the future is some possibility that there is meaningful experience that lies out ahead, and that the God of the good old days, because we're still breathing, seems to be saying there can be good new days as well, not the same. C.S. Lewis says the one prayer God never answers is the prayer encore. You don't ever get back exactly the way it was. But there are new possibilities if you're humble enough and flexible enough and willing to take what is and learn how to make something of that. And so another thing that helped me was realizing that there were still possibilities for meaning in my life. One last thing, and then I'd love to entertain any questions that you might have. One of the things that really has helped me across these years are the people who speak to me of Laura Lou, who tell me stories of their interactions with her. The last thing a grieving person wants is for the deceased to be totally forgotten. And one of our great, great mistakes, I think, is that we don't want to upset people, we say. We don't want to add to their pain, and so we are discreetly silent about, we don't mention the dead person's name, but we never say anything about it. Nothing has been more meaningful to me in the last 32 years than people who knew Laura Lou come and tell me things. I was up at teaching a course at the College of Preachers at the National Cathedral about 10 years ago, and on the bulletin board was a note say call a certain number, and I called, and it turned out it was a young female Episcopal priest who was serving in Washington, and she asked if she could come by and see me. And so we set up an appointment, and when she came, it turned out that she and Laura Lou had been in the same second grade class, and here she was now a priest of the church. And she brought me a picture of herself and of Laura Lou made at their brother's gray white football game. And she said, I found this picture and I heard you were here and I just thought you would like it. And it was so meaningful to me that she remembered, so meaningful that she was willing to talk to me about it. I would encourage you to talk with grieving people about the person who has died and help them to overcome. As it is radically different than life it used to be. But what I have discovered is that my awe at simply being born into this world, my wonder that I'm still breathing, which I take to mean God still wants me to be, still has a future for me, my sense of awe at the mystery of life has been deepened by this experience of loss. And I pray, God, that I have been made more compassionate. I pray now that I don't, when I hear of somebody dying, that I don't just hurry on my own way. I find myself now more open and prone to try to reach out as best I can. I can't fix it. I can't explain it. I can't cure it. But friends, we can help even when we cannot heal. We can bless even if we cannot solve or explain all the problems people are having. There is nothing in the world for me more meaningful than somebody, by what they do and what they say, communicate what happens to you makes a difference to me. I think that's the essence, Lila, of Stephen ministry. What happens to you makes a difference to me, and all of us can do that. You don't have to have a PhD. You don't have to have graduate work in psychology to be genuinely and authentically present and loving and caring to grieving people. Grief calls on us to be very, very brave. And I am so grateful that so many of you are engaged in this kind of ministry. And I pray for you this morning, great courage, great compassion, and a great sense of awe.